Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players as we explore tone and the gear that gets it. And now, here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. Hey, Scott, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Definitely want to say Happy Memorial Day out to all the veterans out there today. It is Happy Memorial Day. And happy birthday to my mother.
That's right. It's your mom. Hey, happy birthday.
And just want to point out, just posted up today a new video on how to string a guitar with a Bigsby using the Vibramate string spoiler, and also showing the Super Grip by Vibramate. And at the end of the video, then I show you how to string up a guitar traditionally on a Bigsby, you know, where you bend the strings and don't ding the top of your guitar, which we've all done.
Yes, I wish you had done that video before I put the Vibramates on my Les Paul. I probably wouldn't have dinged them that much, but that's good that you did that.
Yeah, so that's up there. You can find it on my YouTube channel, Selenium. And then also, definitely want to let everyone know, we have quite a few giveaways coming up. Just so you guys know, you can make sure you keep on checking our website and our Facebook site. So we have, we're giving away an Eminence Governor speaker. We also are giving away an Audio-Technica 10 series wireless guitar unit. The nice thing about those is you can actually use them as a lavalier, guitar, or even all different types of connections. So just because it's guitar doesn't mean you cannot use it for anything else. And then we also have a Wampler Slow Distortion autographed by Brian Wampler himself. So that we'll be giving one of those
out. We had him on the last week. It was a very interesting show.
I didn't
show.
Know he had a first name.
Wampler. Yeah. So the Audio-Technica, we'll be giving away that first. That will be given away on our show coming up in June with Norm from Norm's Rare Guitars. We'll have him on our show. And just to mention some of our other guests we have coming up, we have Analog and Incendio, the band Incendio, Zoom Technologies, Frank Marino.
Who's a Canadian, another Canadian.
And then Kanalea Ukuleles. And for next week's show with Analog Man, we have a coupon code that will be given out to our listeners. So you have to tune in to hear what that is.
That sounds great. Well, let's go ahead and start with the show. We got a lot to talk about today. And you want to have a piece of paper because I'm going to give you a lot of information. We have two great guitar players and great educators here today. First is Nick Stubbs from USC, who is my alma mater. He's assistant professor of practice of studio jazz guitar and popular music over at USC, an expert on guitar and bouzouki, I read.
Oh, wow.
And,
you did your research.
Yeah.
Wow.
And let me give you the information on the Department of Studio Jazz Guitar. It's the USC Thornton School of Music. Their phone number, if you're interested in going there, 213-740-7399, and their website or their email is guitar@usc.edu. Our other guest, Alan Hines, he is an artist in residence at Musicians Institute, which actually Nick was at some point, weren't you?
Right.
So you guys are both alma mater.
I taught there for a few minutes, and I also attended MI in 92.
So that's cool. So we got a little bit of a reunion here.
And I don't remember you because
you were on tour.
I was on tour.
You were on tour.
I felt bad at first.
But anyway, Alan is an artist in residence there, but he's also a professor at this new school of music that he was telling me about, the Cornell School of Contemporary Music, which is part of Shepherd University in Glendale. And some other big, like Abraham Laboriel's teaching there, among others. Sounds like a really cool thing.
Tamara Ruiz, who's down at USC, I think, part-time too, keyboard player from Venezuela.
Great.
He's wonderful.
And to give you the information for Musicians Institute, their number, they have an 800 number, 255-7529, or locally 323-462-1384. Their email is admissions@mi.edu. Their webpage is www.mi.edu, and the Shepherd University, the Cornell School, is www.cornellsu.com. So I just wanted to mention that. Welcome, guys. It's great to have you on the
show.
Thanks
for having us.
Happy Memorial Day.
Yes. Anyway, what I wanted to talk about a little bit is, well, first of all, I was telling you guys earlier before you came to the show, I had graduated in 1977 from SC in School of Music, and studio guitar was new. Duke Miller at that time was doing that. And it was they were kind of adapting from the classical guitar department and trying to make this new department that was trying to be current so that people could get into the industry and actually supply musicians that would do studio work and stuff. Now, the studio type of work that we were doing in the 70s, where we had a cartage company and we would go from studio to studio to studio, I think you'll agree that pretty much doesn't exist anymore. And with the advent of project studios, the way files are transferred through the internet, the whole studio system has changed. And I wanted to ask you guys, how do you feel, has that had a dramatic impact in your, you know, teaching and, you know, your school's, the curriculum?
Well, there's still the TV studio guys who still do the cartage thing, who will have like three duplicate setups in the different studios and they'll go, but that's totally reading, doing soundtrack stuff. But there's probably even less of that even for those guys. I think everybody kind of knows a little bit how to work Pro Tools and Logic. Through the years, we've all kind of learned how to record with computers, of course, coming on just in the last 20 years. We all kind of learned, I mean, I know I did, just to do my own ideas to get them down on recorded. You know, instead of having a cassette tape recorder, you learn how to work Logic or Pro Tools. So everybody that I know who's a guitar player of any level of any sort has a recording system at home. And I know that I do myself. I used to do a couple sessions a week, you know, at least in studios around town. And now it's like all at home. People send me an MP3, and I've got my Avalon preamps and a couple mics, and my stuff's already set up at my house. That's all you need, you know, a good sounding little room and good ears, you know, and learn how to. And, you know, I'm not even a certified, you know, Logic user, but I you know, you could, they're easy enough that you can get in and mess around with them with help from friends. You can really learn the program pretty well. So I do it all the time now. They PayPal me.
Yeah, I noticed that in Musicians Institute curriculum, I was looking it up. They got some interesting stuff that kind of gives you that kind of vocational training. So they have a department in guitar craft where you can learn how to modify, build guitars.
Sure.
They have a music business, which is, I think, is invaluable. They also have audio engineering, and I noticed that part of some of the little classes I was going through there, they have a class in how to use Logic, how to use Pro Tools or those different things.
Well, it's like learning how to set up a pedal board or learn how to wire your rack. It's like everybody I know, every kid that's 18 years old now, and of course, if you have kids or if you know anybody who's that young, you know, they can figure that stuff out like that because they've been, you know, doing cell phones and computers since they were kids. Mm-hmm. So they're like, that's like this part of the whole deal now. I know, at least speaking for MI, that's, you know, I was there in 1985 when it was pretty much just guitar, bass, and drums is all there was at the school.
Right.
And, you know, from the school of Tommy Tedesco, Larry Carlton, we just all wanted to be like kind of studio players, be able to read to a certain amount and be able to create parts. And now it's like, boy, it's like all encompassing of, you know, you have to know how to look the part, how to, you know, you have to know Logic, you have to know how to record your own stuff, how to do beats and loops, and it's a whole different world. And
It's a little more all-inclusive now. For example, like at USC, I teach a reading class, and I have a tough time at the very beginning, the first semester, first day. I have to tell the students, okay, we're going to work on reading. Is this something that is still necessary for a modern guitar player? And we go through what are the places where you can use this skill, and they're fewer than they were maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But we're still trying to teach the traditional music skills to the students. But we're trying to update them and make them realize that you have to be creative in how you're going to use these tools. Like you said, everyone's got a home recording studio, and you do a lot of recording. There are still studio musicians. I still do sessions. I just don't drive to people's studios to do them. I do them at home, and you stay in your pajamas, and you plug in your amp, and you do it from your home, and you send the files over via internet. So there's still that skill set in demand, and there's a lot of work available for good, strong musicians in today's music world, I think.
Do you think that the newer students are better readers than before? Do you still see a lot of people that just play?
Well, we had talked about this a little earlier too. I know that at MI, the proficiency level at MI is like high. There's a lot of students that come into MI first quarter who have blazing technique because they grew up with YouTube,
right.
And they know how to do all the skills. Now, playing an interesting solo is a whole different thing, or being able to write a really nice melody that's a whole different world, or playing something with soul or feeling. But as far as technique goes, I have to say that there's some kids who have come through that are just phenomenal in the technical world.
Well, the YouTube thing has greatly changed the educational system for music, I think, because I often think of it as content versus context. Content is not important as much as it used to be. When I was starting to play guitar, content was very hard to acquire. Like, I grew up in a small town in Saskatchewan, and if I wanted to learn my scales or my arpeggios or my voicings, it was a difficult thing to acquire, and you had to know someone that had that content, or you had to purchase a book, and the resources were quite limited. Now, everyone has the content. I could pull out my phone and give you content to last you until the end of time.
Sure.
So context becomes key, where you work on how do you apply that information, because you'll see students at MI, I'm sure, that have great chops, but maybe their timing isn't great, and they haven't found those details and those nuances that you as an expert can help them and tell them, hey, this is where you should hone your skills a little bit further. And that's where the educational system has not become irrelevant because of things like the internet.
Right.
Because you still need that human interaction to say, hey, this is what you can improve. That said, people are starting at a higher level than they used to,
I think so too. Yeah, they have the facility. I mean, we have one student, his name is Frederick, but we all call him Shredrick. Because he's just got a phenomenal technique. I mean, he is just beautiful in his playing. But the first thing what I teach at MI is I do a thing called open counseling, which is a great, which is my favorite thing. When I was a student at MI, 100 years ago, I used to go and just sit down with Scott Henderson or Jeff Berlin or Joe DiOrio or Joe Pass or Robin Ford and just sit with them one-on-one. I could stop them at any time. It was like a private lesson with these guys every day. But what I do, and this happens probably 90% of the time, is a student will start playing a solo. We might be playing over, All the Things You Are, or we might be playing over a C minor jam. And you can tell out of the box where their time is. And that always is the thing that separates the guys who you think have a potential, or the men from the boys, because when guitar players have a tendency to rush like crazy. And to me, that's like fingernails on the chalkboard. You can spot it. And, usually the kids are a little nervous. Most times they're not even patting their foot. And so there's ways you can get them to kind of get their time better. And one of the things, I always tell them to record themselves. If they record them, even they record like 5 minutes of their own playing, they're going to hear, immediately, my time is terrible. Every time I go to the C minor chord, I rush or whatever. Mm-hmm. They start at a higher level. They have scales, and most of them even know a lot of the modes, but it's still the practical. You need to have somebody sit there and say, no, that's rushing right there. That's wrong because of this,
And you see a lot of, I've noticed when a guitar player becomes more experienced, they know how to intonate the instrument much more detailed. You hear a mature player, their intonation is much cleaner, it's much more in tune, and younger players might be playing the right notes, but they might not be in time, and might not be intonated as well as possible.
And those are things you can't teach on YouTube.
You can't teach that on YouTube.
With a video of somebody playing.
So I was worried a few years ago, what happens with all this information on YouTube? Is education a thing that we won't need instructors in universities? But we do, because we need people to teach those things, because that's something you can't learn from a video.
Plus, the interaction between teacher and student when I first got the job at MI, it was just a job out of school for me to start teaching, and it was just for me to pay rent. But then I came to love it, just because I love seeing a student who just connects with you, and they get it, and it makes them want to practice that much stronger. And that's one thing you can't get on YouTube either. The personal relationship with the student is really important.
Well, it's the little quips of advice that you can get, that you get on the moment. It'll trigger something. I was doing this gig, and I had to do this, and I solved it this way, or whatever it is. That's when I took classes with Duke, he would just say, reminds me of this session I did this thing, and invaluable information that you would never know.
Sure. I used to sit with Robin Ford. Robin Ford is what everybody should know is one of the best, you know, fusion blues players in the world. And he was at MI one week out of every month, the whole year I was there. So I would skip all my classes and go sit with him. And it, what was great, you could just stop and say, "What was that? Or what do you think of this?" You know, and to see it firsthand, you know, from like 4 feet away is a pretty wonderful thing. Yeah. But you can't do that on YouTube either.
And I want to say something. You talk about it, which SE is more of a traditional approach to music. True story. When I was in school, it was mainly a classical program. They were kind of adapting the classical program. I had a session years later, but before MIDI, a disco session, the drummer could not hit the bass drum. I conducted him and got him to do it by conducting, learned from learning how to conduct. It worked. I wasn't playing on the session, but they like, what do we do? We can't get this guy to sync it. And there was no Pro Tools. There was no, you know, beat detective. There was none of that stuff. So I actually had to conduct him, and he followed me, and I was able to get him to do it. True story. So those little things that you learn. Also, too, you were saying about reading music and stuff. When you're dealing with musicians from other countries, or you're dealing with other musicians from other instruments, that's your common ground. You have those notes. Well, it usually evens the field, and you can actually...
And also, I remember one time when I was at school, we had an instructor named Ralph Humphrey, who's a great drummer who played with Frank Zappa and stuff. And he liked the way I played, and so he was going to give me a tour of Warner Brothers Studios. So we went over there one afternoon, and I met the guitar player. His guitar player's name was John Gu, who's still very active in the TV thing. This guy's a great player. But I remember looking at his music on his stand and going, "Oh my God, how is he going to read this?" It was just like a cluster of all these rhythms. And I was going, "Oh, this is no way. This is so far over me." So he sat down, and he turned on his amp, and the band starts, and he's going... like that, and I was going, "Oh, that's all it is." But that's the whole thing. I realized that if in the studio, they don't have time to sit there and say, "Hey, it goes like this." You've got to nail it just like that, because it's got to sync up with the film, or it's got to be, you know, you're playing with a big band, it's got to be exact. So there's like no room for improv there, or you know, that's
pretty.
That's where playing reading music comes in really handy.
Though I have to another Lee Ritenour. We were talking about Lee Ritenour. He was in school when I was there. And he had told me there was a Zappa session. I don't know if he was there at the session, but there was this famous vibe player. I can't remember the name. And Zappa had this music written out, just flurry of notes. So the
Ruth guy, Underwood?
Maybe? Yeah, I think it was. And so he, you know, she, they're playing, you know, she's playing it. And he stopped and, no. And he took the sticks and he said, "It's like this." And he played the thing. And she's like, I mean, he just... You know, it's like this. He knew exactly what he wanted, and she was like floored. And even Lee's like, he actually read. It's not like he just wrote a bunch of notes and, you know, let's see what it sounds like.
He's
pretty amazing.
I think he surprised a lot of people who at the time, even Tommy Tedesco talked about meeting Frank Zappa and how they went into it thinking, "Mothers of Invention, oh, this is going to be a bunch of noise," you know. And they went into it and they were amazed with his level of professionalism and how great of a thinker he was of music. You know,
it's true. So, go ahead.
Oh, and one of the things I want to ask you, since we were talking about YouTube, how do your guys' schools prepare guitarists and, you know, your students for the multimedia environment that we're in now? So it's not just going out and releasing a CD and going out and touring. It's everything. You know, you have to do video, audio, promote yourself.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm jumping in here and speaking before you, but I think a lot of students come into school already kind of knowing that more than a lot of their professors do. Because kids these days are so... tuned in. I mean, if you've ever had, I'm 56 years old now, so whenever I have a problem with my computer or with my, you know, something on my phone, I give it to somebody who's like 18 years old, and they're like, bang, bang, bang. They just go right. They just know where everything is, it's like second nature to them, the way the parameters work on those kind of things. So I think they know a lot of it. I mean, they're already so keen to Facebook and, but I'm sure they have like business classes. They probably cover a lot of it.
At USC, we have, we have a business, we have a lot of business classes. We have a music technology and a music industry program department. And the students have opportunity to take those classes, become a little more proficient at Pro Tools than, let's say, the way I use Pro Tools is from experience. I never took a course on how to use Pro Tools. But I'm sure if I took a course on it, I'd probably be at the level I'm at now much, much faster. So
right.
The students can jump in at the level that they're at, because maybe they already have 5-10 years of experience with that program, so that they can go to to a higher level and get some really detailed instruction on how to use that program from someone that's an expert. So they can, at USC, we have plenty of experts in different fields, so the students can, in the curriculum, have room to
So that's part of the curriculum for them to take technology and...
Right. Yeah.
And I think most young students, most young guitar players, I mean, look, you and I, we all grew up in like the era of Mecca for guitar players back in the 60s and 70s. There's guitar solos on every song in the radio, whether it was the Doobie Brothers or Beatles. There was always a great guitar solo in every song. Now I think the only genre you hear guitar solos is maybe country music, you know, where there's really blazing solos. So even my guitar students who are 20 years old, they're so tuned in with so much more. They're like so into loops and production values and how to write that big hook that, to me, you know, when I watch the Grammys, it sounds like kind of genetically engineered songs, you know, because it's like these hooks that don't sound like they would sound like they were spit out of a computer as opposed to actually written by somebody sitting around introspectively on their instrument. You know, that's a different subject. But most of my students are, even the guitar enthusiasts, are still well aware of everything else it takes to make a hit record. At least maybe at MI, they really concentrate a lot at that school on more than just being a guitar player.
Well, I remember when Musicians Institute came out and my friends that took it. I didn't go there, but you had tapes. You could have tapes. You could go into the library and listen to the tapes. How do you guys use today's technology now? I presume do you guys use YouTubes to teach, or besides, you know, you obviously have a website you download, you know, their lessons and
that.
So you guys integrate that now in there, right?
I assume when I say an artist or a song, like for example, if someone's working on their bending and I say, you know, have you listened to the Kings, Albert King, Freddie King, B.B. King? And they go, no, I haven't heard them. Now I can assume that they can access that information immediately. So it can be an assignment. You have to listen to these recordings. Where prior to the internet, it would have been you had to go to the record store, go to Tower Records or Virgin Records, and buy that record, and then
right.
wait for that. There was a process, you know. I always tell this story. I don't know if it's a true story, but about the Beatles, where they were looking at a lead sheet and it had a B7 chord, and none of the Beatles knew how to play a B7 chord, so they had to get on a bus in Liverpool and go across the other end of town and find some old guy that knew how to play a B7 chord. So they had to invest pretty heavily to get a B7 chord. So that's not our reality today. So we can get to that information quicker, and we can use it if you're aware that that's where we're at. You can get to 60 pretty immediately instead.
Right,
of,
right.
Instead
it's of more everything's accessible more.
Right.
Same token though, there's so much stuff out there that it just becomes a big. It's hard. I keep an iPad in the little room that I teach at MI all the time. When students come in, if they've never heard of, there's a lot of new players out like Val McCollum or Blake Mills, Blake Mills is playing with, you know, Lucinda Williams and Fiona Apple, and he's producing Sarah Watkins, and he's like 25 years old, and this guy is like Ry Cooder on steroids at age 25. He's just a wonderful slide player. These kids would never have heard of them. And so I have to say, several times through the day, I have my iPad, I say, have you ever heard of Blake Mills? No, man. I go, well, check him out, because he's just signed to Verve Records, and he's like an up-and-coming guy who's doing everything. His production is modern, but he also has like the old-school stuff, and these students would never find them. You know, or Jeff Buckley, guys like that, guys who are around. A lot of students wouldn't know who they were because they get lost in the billions of...
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there.
It goes both ways. For example, Blake Mills, I hadn't heard of his music, and a student actually turned me on to his music. So there's a synergy that happens... and you go back and forth and you share information, and ideally it's about the relationships again, and it's about learning from each other. Obviously sometimes experience helps in that the person that has a little more experience can contribute some perspective, historical perspective.
Sure. And having a computer right there by your side, you can go, here, check them out.
Right.
Do you ever hear Eric Clapton play this solo with Cream or In Presence of the Lord, and you go, bam, here it is. That's a wonderful thing.
That is kind of cool. Now, I don't mean this to be critical of your schools, but let me ask you this question. How do you think that the programs that are at both of your institutions Do you think they're successful in showing the kids, the students, how to get into the workforce, how to get into? Do you think it's relevant? I mean, I'm sure a lot of it is with the technology and stuff, but one of the things I remember when I was at school, they didn't really tell you how to get a job, how to get in there and get into the industry, and that was one of the things Duke Miller, who set up the original guitar department at SC, that was a big thing for him. How do you assess that?
Well, I think some things you can't teach. You know, there's some things you just have to get out and be social to a certain point where you have to have a certain amount of people skills. Some of that you can't teach. But I know I can speak for MI because I don't know USC's program too well. But I know that MI has been constantly experimenting with stuff over the years. They've always tried to introduce classes. You know, I talk in my, when I do I do master classes around the world. I just came back from Holland last month. And some of the stuff I talk about is like, you know, the guy you're sitting next to in the class right now, he might be like the next producer 10 years from now, who's the guy you're going to want to know. So you have to have some social skills, you know, to kind of know people and you hang out with people and, you know, hopefully and that kind of stuff. I don't know if they have classes really directly for that, but that's something that I always talk about to my students and in my master classes, how important it is just to get out and do the schmooze factor.
At USC, we have some of the students for 4 years. Some of them go on to get a master's degree, which is another couple years. Some go on to get a doctorate degree. So what happens is, after you've spent that much time with someone, you can really work on their career. You can say what... I looked on Facebook today and I saw Charles Altura playing with Chick Corea. Okay, now, he's one of our graduates. And he played really well. Like, he was going to get that gig because he just played so well. But I'm sure someone mentored him along the way and maybe said, hey, you could do this or you could do that, and gave him some advice on how to get into that that specific place where his career is now.
I know Charles, he's kind of an exception just because he is so phenomenally...
He's phenomenally gifted,
he's
right?
He's really great. And if you hear him one time, you're going to go, oh my God, what is he doing? You know, he's really, he's that good. He's not just a guy who might have a bad night, you're going to go, oh, he's pretty good. It's like every time I've seen Charles, he's like
amazing,
really,
right?
He's really an amazing player. And he's very shy. He's a very introverted guy. He's not really outgoing, like a kind of guy who's going to go... And actually, Blake Mills is very similar. You know, they're not really the kind of guys who are going to be in your face at their stuff. They're just both really talented.
But when someone's that talented, you know that there's a place for them in the world, and you try to encourage them. And then sometimes people need to work on certain skills. I have some students that say, I would like to get into this type of work. And then you look at their skill set and you diagnose it and say, well, if you want to do that, you're going to have to get your tones better, more together, or you might need to become a better reader, or you might need to work on your repertoire a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So you try to listen to the student and where their career is pointing and see if you can help them get there more effectively and with less hardship along the way.
And so much of it is mental, too. I mean, the confidence, you know, the students who I know that have gone on to do great things who have graduated from MI or students who, they had a certain confidence. They were just very sure of themselves. And maybe it was the level of cockiness sometimes, sure. But they had that, well, I was going to tell you this one story a second ago. I was thinking about a Japanese student I had who was came into my open counseling, and he would kind of sit there and listen. He was so shy. He could barely speak. He was so just scared because he was a little timid guy. And after about 6 months of sitting in there, I kind of kept talking to him, say, oh, it's fine, try this, and I'd kind of get him. And he kind of came out of his shell, and he came as that great little player who's, like, playing great. He lives back in Tokyo now, and he's a great player. Can play over any changes, great feel. So, you know, guys blossom like that. And I think with the help of teachers who can kind of see that and kind of push them in the right direction. You know?
Yeah, I think you just to be able to network, you have to have an ego, and I don't mean ego in a negative sense. You have to be able to say, hey, I'm here, and I want to introduce myself. I play, and I do this.
Right.
So I do agree, but that's good that you bring that out. And it's refreshing to know that from both of you guys talking, you are customizing what you're teaching to help them bring out what they need. That wasn't there yet at the time. And this is not a criticism of the old school where I was, but at that time they didn't know how to really do that. It seems that you kind of customize, you kind of evaluate, and it's more specific for each student.
Yeah, I think you kind of have to. Because, like, you know, so you can learn stuff. You can teach anybody a scale, you know, you can teach anybody to play the scale or that chord, but it's like there's so much more involved. And when you mention like getting work outside of school, it's one thing to be a good player, and it's another thing to have the social skills or the confidence in yourself to actually go out there and present yourself and make those connections.
One thing that I'm seeing at SC that I'm really happy to see happening is that lately we're willing to change the recipe a little bit. We're not stuck in the ways of 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and we're constantly reevaluating, rethinking, and trying to get it a little better each day. Sometimes we fail, but sometimes we get closer, and I think that there's an openness to keep on progressing, because the world changes, and if you use the same rules, the same ideas, the same thoughts of yesteryear for today, you're probably going to have negative results.
Yeah,
that's probably true with anything. You got to be open to failure, because that's where you learn the most, isn't it? You know,
in
every level.
Yeah. You wanted to say something?
Yeah, so I kind of want to turn the table a little bit, but with you guys both brought guitars. So, Nick, you have an R9.
R9.
Gibson R9 reissue, and then you have a gold top 54 converted to 57.
Mm-hmm.
So, since you have your guitars, what I'm kind of curious in is to show with blues, because you actually co-authored a book on blues scales, right? I thought. Playing the blues rhythm guitar, correct?
Okay.
All right. So when people come in and they want to play the blues, let's use that as an example, what skills are they lacking the most that you
see? They need to be depressed, of course, right?
Yeah. right.
Come back in 20 years.
We can do that.
Like, maybe you can you show us on your guitar where you think they should be going, in the sense of what they're missing. Like, most people probably would get stuck in just a pentatonic scale. So what in the blues scales
before
realm?
You even play, I'm sure that time is like one of the major things, right? Getting students to play, even like especially comping for rhythm.
You know,
comping, a lot of kids
here,
don't.
Well, that's I was going to say that. I mean, that's one thing I tell in my master classes, is like, you know, 98% of the work you're going to do when you're out of school is with a band. So you're going to be playing with other people in an ensemble. So you need to learn how to like work and groove with other musicians.
You know, with a subject like the blues, a lot of times students feel pretty comfortable with that, because they know what a 12-bar blues is, just because they've heard it a little bit. So they usually sometimes have an ego that's unhealthy, where they're like, I already know how to do this. Why are you making me do something that I already know? And that's where the context becomes important again, because the content they already understand. Mm-hmm. 12 mm-hmm. bars, three chords, the 1, 4, and 5, we're good. What else do I need to know? Mm-hmm. So I usually try to see where the bottleneck is. Do you understand the form? Okay, if they understand the form, do you understand how the melodies interact with the chords? That's another thing. Thirdly, can you play a solo without someone accompanying you? Like, that's usually the litmus test right there, because all of a sudden their quick licks don't work because they don't have someone to hold them steady. So the timing becomes apparent right away.
Yeah, of course. And I was just thinking about a lot of my students, it's when you mentioned, like, I get them to play by themselves, because that way you can really hear what they're playing. I mean, it's one thing, because blues guitar, it's a simple art form. It's like simple pentatonic forms. It's not really supposed to be notey or a lot of scales, although it can be, but it's not really, that's, you know, I get my students to listen to Freddie King, number one, go back and listen to mm-hmm. Freddie King, Albert King, and those, and that kind of stuff, but, you know, but try to get them to play a solo with nobody playing chords,
right?
And that's like a big thing from the I said, oh, I want to hear that four chord, I want to hear that, you know, I want to hear when he goes to that four chord, you know, and it kind of forces them to kind of outline the chords a little bit, so you can actually, it sounds like they're playing a solo.
Yeah.
I don't know, but my main thing is time for students, because I get, that's, you know, you can't play the blues if you're rushing like crazy.
Can't play pretty much anything.
Well, that's true. Yeah,
if you don't know where one is, you've got to swing.
Late 70s punk feels good when it's rushed a little.
One thing I think that is important to have, you know, where we were talking about all this stuff on the internet and stuff, is that I think a teacher face to face is important, is the teach feel. Now let me ask you, because, like, for example, my early session work that I was doing, I did a lot of funk stuff, and it made it a lot easier. Like, I hear a lot of people that love Hendrix and stuff, but they just don't get that feel, and it's a funk-based type of a blues funky type of thing. And my question to both of you guys is, is how do you get, do you see a lot of students that know all the notes, know all the scales, but they just don't know how to feel it? And sure. what do you do to get them to feel it?
You know, I have to say, it's worked both ways. When I was a student, I was kind of really an Alan Holdsworth. I have a book coming out on Hal Leonard that's going to be out before the end of the year. It's called Legato Techniques or something, they titled it. But I was really an Alan Holdsworth at the time. And I was like, man, I was practicing my melodic modeling, my whole tone scales, and I knew how to play these fast chromatic lines. And I got my first session after graduating from MI. And this was like 1986. So this was with a drum machine playing funk stuff. And so it was really a machine. I mean, there was like, it didn't have any human qualities to it at all, you know. So I remember I went in there, and all it was like an R&B song, and all they wanted to hear was something like, or something like that. And I came in there going, and it's like totally the wrong guy for the call, you know. But then I realized, then I said, oh, it's time to go back to work, you know. And I actually went back and just started, you know, I actually found it very valuable to start transcribing all those guitar parts with James Brown or Earth, Wind & Fire or Paul Jackson Jr. is the king of all the rhythm stuff. And then I was going to say, on the other hand, I know some guys, there's a great saxophone player, I'll not mention his name, but he's one of the best improvisers in jazz standards, and we did a gig together, a smooth jazz gig. It was just a vamp in C minor. And on stage, he turns around to me, and he goes, Alan, what do you play? It's C Dorian. Are you kidding me? You've been playing, I've heard you play with giant steps at 300 beats per minute. And he just had, so it's different schools, you know? Yeah. But
you know, one thing, like you said, how do you get a student to work on their feel?
Turn down?
Well, one thing I notice is you have to make sure that they understand just the basic fundamentals. Like, can they do the most simple version of that? Like, if you're doing funk grooves and it's 16th notes, there are only four possible attacks within a beat. So one thing I ask them to do is, can you play tapping your foot and then... You know, and you'd be surprised how many people fold on that simple exercise. Four beats on the first beat, first subdivision, four beats on the second. Most people, like, by somewhere in the middle have already folded, or their foot has gone crazy. And right there, you know, that's just a fundamental. So that you can work on.
Mm-hmm. I tell my students also, instead of seeing, if you're thinking four beats to a measure as dots on a page, think of each dot as big as a huge, as the size of that wall, a big sphere. And you can either play it on this side of the dot or this side of the dot.
Right,
that's how the different feels can, you know, when people talk about playing in the pocket or playing on top of the, what does that mean? So a lot of students kind of go, what does that mean, playing in the pocket? And then, you know, I try to sit down and give them an example with a drum machine of, you know, the difference between and where it feels a lot better. Of course, I have the drum groove going on to really demonstrate. But yeah. It's, once again, it kind of comes down to time, you know, and knowing where to place the stuff. Yeah, sure.
And then back to your initial question, Scott.
Which was?
With the blues.
Right.
You know, you have to, it's about the vocabulary and understanding just the basic chords and understanding something as simple as just moving from that note to that. You know, that's really all it is. And then going.
Yeah, that's true.
Why don't you guys just jam for a little bit and show us?
We already are, man.
I know. Yeah. Just...
Thank you.
Both of those guys are playing in the neck pickup, just so you guys know. It's really the only pickup for blues. So
this one's good too. The other exactly. one,
well, maybe not here.
And it's also confirms that these guys know about tone, which is important. So if you're going to these schools, these guys know how to get the tone and get the sound. I mean,
you know,
they're using very basic setups here and two Les Pauls, and it's just amazing. The tone is, you guys have a great sound.
Well, you know, the thing, I like guitars, I love amps, I love speakers, I love distortion pedals, I love everything about that.
Mm-hmm.
But the pick works pretty well too for shading your tone. You can get a lot of tonal variations out of the way you pick. Mm-hmm. And one thing that that I find when you're working with a student is like just telling them that the angle of the pick can really, like, I play parallel, sounds pretty mid-range full, but if I so
and I have even more unorthodox style where I hold the pick with three fingers and turn it sideways, so
right.
I get this kind of, like, instead of having this that kind of attack, I have I have a brush top, because I do all that legato stuff, so if my left hand is strong enough, I can go.
Yeah, you can't see it on the on the radio show, but what he's doing is he's also pulling the pick up instead of a downstroke.
Most of all upstrokes. And then he's hammer on.
And when he was playing, when Alan was playing, he was also going from pick to fingers a lot.
I use my fingers a lot, and that's probably, like, I listened to Joe Pass a lot when I was growing up, and Jeff Beck. Jeff Beck's the man, you know, and he's a great example of all the different variations you get. I have a friend that hired him to do work with Stanley Clarke, and they did a soundtrack several years ago, and they flew Jeff in, and they rented a Jeff Beck Strat from Guitar Center, and rented a Marshall Stack from Guitar Center. Nothing's fancy about anything. Mm-hmm. It wasn't any kind of fancy boutique pedal or anything. And Jeff walked in with his little Allen wrench set up the guitar, and then just plugged in and went. And that's all he did. And they said it was so varied in the tones he would get out of the thing. Because if you watch any videos with Jeff Beck, and this is everybody who wants to learn how to play with good tones should watch Jeff Beck up close, and there's some videos of him. He's constantly working the tone knobs and the volume knobs and playing up here at the fretboard and playing back.
Using the full range.
Yeah, he goes all over the place.
You can get down. It sounds like you're doing a harmonic by picking back by the bridge.
Yeah.
And then he's like, you know, and then turning this pick up and turning down the volume, and he's just a master. He's just in so much control over all the things a guitar can do.
No, I remember I heard it in a studio. He was this guy went in there and they just saw this beat up Strat just trashed, and they're like, he thought it was like unplayable, and Beck walked in and just it sang.
I heard you can. I heard you give Jeff Beck an out of tune guitar and he makes it sound in tune. You know.
I think that's a story I heard one time. Somebody gave him a guitar one time that was all wacky out of tune, and it had a Floyd Rose on it or something at the time, but he still played and it sounded perfect because he was just constantly adjusting with the wang bar. So there's a lot to tone besides going to Guitar Center and buying the most expensive stuff.
Right.
No offense, Guitar Center, but I mean, there's, you know.
Well,
it's in your fingers. And you've heard different people pick up the same guitar and they sound completely
different. Yeah, I know a guy, a friend of mine, he plays. He's played everybody's guitar and bad guitars, and he still sounds great. And I played the same guitar, and I couldn't get it to do that.
You know,
amazing.
One more story. I'm still good friends with a guy named Scott Henderson, who's a great fusion guitar player.
Yes.
And Scott and I were both, we had the same kind of rig set up with the kind of a, almost like a Bradshaw where we could switch our pedals in a rack, and we had, I had like Lexicon reverbs and the compression, and we were always, I was over at his house 3 times a week comparing Mogami cable to the George L cable, and you know, we were driving ourselves batty, honestly, just trying to get what we thought was the best tone. And you know, from one day to another, it would vary depending on probably what we ate more than really what it really sounded like, you know. And then I saw an interview with this guy named Stuart Smith, who plays with the Eagles now, who I had heard play with Joni Mitchell. And on this one song called How Do You Stop, it's just the most beautiful guitar tone. And I he was finally a guitar player, and I was going, oh, man, I'm going to find out what his secret is. I'm going to find out which rack he's using or which cable he's using. And I just pictured him having a southern accent because I know he's from Nashville. And he goes... and his, when they ask him about his gear, he goes, yeah, you know, I've had the same twin reverb and the same Vibrolux for the last 40 years. He goes, and they go, what, they ask him about pedals. He goes, oh, I think I have one Boss compressor and one Boss delay. And he has a couple of nice guitars. He has some old Stratocasters, but, you know, there you go. And that's when I said,
yeah, how do you stop? That's a killer guitar.
That's, it's a beautiful tone, you know. That, and he does stuff like he'll slap, you know, like harmonics up a... Hit the harmonic and shake it with a vibe with a tremolo arm. So he's another guy who just gets great tones in his fingers, and that's when I sold all my rack gear. And went to a pedal board and just started using these pedals and true bypass right into a good quality amp.
Everyone has gone through this where they chase an idea so far that they get further away from the truth. I remember in the 80s I had a rack mount system, and I would make presets every week trying to get closer to a better tone. And I remember they were sequential. So bank one and then bank two.
Sure.
So at the end of the tour, I listened to bank 10 and compared it to the first one. And it was not as good as my first instinct was.
Right.
So what I learned is that sometimes if you over tweak, overthink, you start to second guess yourself and you become confused. And I've heard Robin Ford say this too. Like he plays a lot of different amps and he always sounds the same. He always sounds great. And he says he spends maybe a few seconds, 20, 30 seconds. He turns a few knobs. He realizes what it is. He accepts that. And then he moves
works
from that,
around
works
it, yeah.
from that
of
point.
Course, yeah.
Like if your sound is a certain way and it's not as lush as you wanted, it's maybe doesn't have as much bottom end, you will have to just accept it and start playing with
right.
that
I mean,
as your...
It's a common thing that students want to sound like their heroes, you know, and so they automatically go on that chase where they start, you know, Mike Landa, who's... Once again, he's got incredible time and great feel in his fingers, and you know, so of course, even back when I was doing a lot of studio work in the 80s and 90s, you know, we all wanted to. How did he get that sound? So I'd go buy that Lexicon because I saw that he had it. You know, that Soldano amp, I got to get it. You know, so there was Keeping Up with the Joneses, and everybody kind of, and actually some producers back then, if they didn't see you walk in with a big rack,
right.
they wouldn't think you were the professional that they wanted to hire, that they were paying $300 for a session.
No, I never had a full rack system. I used a lot of pedals all the time, but there was a certain point where I just stopped using them for a while and just played just the guitar and the amp.
And I think nowadays that's really much more accepted than it was like probably. Like
oh then. Yeah.
Back then you kind of
no,
had
that's
to have
true.
The whole thing.
But it's like what you were just saying about, you know, you went back and you looked at the sound and it was better. It's like in production, as a producer, you see diminishing returns. There's a certain point where you're just beating it. It's just going to go down. So you have to know that spot where, okay, that's as good as it's going to get and go for it. You know, let it.
Well,
let
back to the educational thing. That's how it is with learning how to improvise. Sometimes you go into this place where you start playing worse for a little while, but you need someone to kind of guide you and like to kind of set you straight so that you don't completely lose your way. Because it can get really frustrating. I remember when I went to MI, there was a period where I felt like I couldn't play anything. I went wrong way.
I've come. That's part of my teaching process. I can expect any of my good students at some point through the year. Think that they suck more than anything, and I've got to, you know, it's like a, I feel like I should get a degree in psychology just
right.
to kind of, because you got to learn how to, you know, like my students, one thing students do, which is really common when they make a mistake, especially when they're on stage performing in front of anybody, they get really self-conscious and they'll make this face, they'll make this face, they kind of wince, you know, they kind of grimace, and I go, okay, number one, don't make the face. That's, you know, that's not a scale you have to practice, that's nothing you have to do, just don't make the face because everything's connected. And you make that face, you automatically think you doubt yourself. If you're not going to make that face, you're going to keep your cool, and nobody's going to know. And believe me, 80% of the people out there don't know if you're making a mistake or not. You
right.
know it much more than anybody else does, you know.
Well, we're almost at the end here. One last question, and then I'm thinking instead of taking the normal music out, we'll have you guys jam out. Where do you think it's going in terms of guitar, studio guitar, just in general? Like you had mentioned that now most of the guitar works in country music, but where do you think, where do you see it going?
I really see things are much more inclusive than they were in the past. It is, when I went to college, I remember hanging out with some of the violinists that played in the orchestra, and I'd ask them, what are they listening to? And they were listening to Brahms and Bruckner, and they were listening to the music they were playing. But now when you talk to the violinists, you say, what are you listening to? What's on your iPod? And they're listening to some new hip-hop recording. They're listening to something that you wouldn't expect them to. And I think there's a tolerance for including all different types of music. So I think the student that is historically aware and has studied all the various styles and is current and looking for the next thing, but also pays homage and shows reverence to the past, will probably be successful. I think it's like a combination of modern and old sounds mixed together, because everything comes back in style. I remember when I was a kid, there was the disco burning at Shea Stadium. Remember when they burnt all the disco records? There was like 50,000 people showed up to burn disco recordings. And Donna Summers was inducted into the Hall of Fame last week. So it's like it comes full circle at some point. So you just have to be aware.
Yeah, I guess it's true. I mean, I have some friends that are much younger, 20 years younger than I am, and their concept is so much different than mine as far as what I like in music or what they listen to and how they. But if there's one thing I always encourage my students to do, and this is one thing I think that will never change, is I encourage them to like write music. You know, get your thoughts out and get your ideas recorded, because that's where you. That's a whole another radio show talking about the whole, you know, finishing a song, making it work, getting it recorded, learning how to work with people to get it recorded, and then believing enough to give it out there to the world and bury yourself. And it's such a self-gratifying thing, and it's a feeling like you've left something behind when you leave this world, you know. So I encourage my students, no matter, and I've been doing this for years, is, you know, write, because no matter what you're doing with your music, that's the stuff that you're going to leave your message, you know, you're going to leave your mark in the world. If you write songs, you know, that's, you know, there's always room for good writing, good compositions, you know.
No. Thank you guys both. Everybody, check out the websites for both USC and Musicians Institute, great places.
And Cornell?
And that's right, the Cornell School of Contemporary under Shepherd University.
New school.
Really great stuff. Thank you guys so much. We're definitely going to have you guys on again. We just touched the surface of all of this. So we're going to leave you, everybody, and we're going to let them jam our way out. And have a good week, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, next week we have Mike Piera, Analog Man, will be our guest. And again, make sure you tune in for that show for a 10% discount code offered through his website. So that will be on our show next week.
Okay.